Support for this podcast comes from Troy University, dedicated to teaching a new generation to lead change. Information on leadership opportunities available to students from day one is at troy.edu/leadchange.
From Troy Public Radio, I'm Tim Phillips, and this is Clarinet Corner. Today I'm joined in the studio by a clarinet luminary who I have known of my entire adult life. I'm so grateful to have him here today. His name is Charles West. Charles, hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
For my listeners who don't know, Charles West was the clarinet professor at Virginia Commonwealth University for the majority of his career. He was the president also of the International Clarinet Association, and he has some beautiful recordings, some of which I've played on the show before, and he's coming through town today, and it's just such a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
I was thinking, I think the last time I had an in-studio guest was pre-COVID. I think you're my first one since the world shut down.
Hopefully the microphone's not contaminated. We'll come out of here okay.
Yes, we're all good. And it's just such a pleasure to have you here. So tell me about your clarinet upbringing. Like, where did you study? Who did you study
with? Well, I'm from northern Colorado. It was a small town of Fort Collins, Colorado. Of course, it's a big town now. But I started on piano as a kid. Mm-hmm. I heard Benny Goodman, and I just thought, wow, what a cool thing he does.
Me too.
Yeah, really. You know, there's more to that story, and I can tell you in a minute. But so I started the clarinet, but the band directors were saying, oh, you have a piano background, and you should be an oboist. So they gave me an oboe with a crack in it, and it didn't work, and I tried to make it work, and I finally said, I'm going to go back to clarinet. And so that was kind of, ended up playing my doctoral qualifying recital on oboe, saxophone, and clarinet. But that was a beginning of oboe that started in college, not in middle school. So yeah, I was playing junior high band and went to Colorado State University band camp and ended up in Colorado All-State Band, All-State Orchestra and in high school. And I went to Northern Colorado and majored in music education. And when it looked like I was going to get done too early, meaning I would have been 1A eligible to be drafted, I said, well, you know, I could pile on a second degree in performance. And so I did the double degree, which just extended my undergraduate degree to 4 years, because we had a four-year deferment. And then I became 1A after that.
Wow. And then you studied with one of my former teacher's teachers, the very famous Jaime Voxman.
Oh, yeah.
At the University of Iowa. And for my listeners who don't know, Jaime Voxman taught at the University of Iowa forever. I think like he was there for 40, 50 years, something like that.
At least, well, he was the director of the school for over 30 years, I think.
Yeah, so he was a clarinet teacher, director of the school. And they named the building after him.
The new building is named Voxman Hall.
The other one flooded, I guess.
Yeah, that was on, I guess, kind of like reclaimed land down by the Iowa River. The Iowa River would flood, but it really flooded at one point. And the recital hall, I understand, sunk a few inches, and it was condemned. The building was condemned. And actually, after Jaime's wife passed away, even before, but particularly after, I would go to Iowa City with my rental car and pick him up, and we'd go out for lunch and stuff. And I took him by Voxman Hall when he was 99 years old.
Wow.
It wasn't really coherent. He's, I don't know where I am. I said, don't worry, Jaime, I'll get you home.
Oh, man. And that building is a $150 million building.
You mean the new building?
The new building,
oh,
yes.
Oh, yeah, it's just state-of-the-art.
It is stunning. Beautiful recital halls. I've looked at it many times online. I have a former student who's there. And, yeah, man, it's really nice, and it's such a great legacy to Mr. Voxman. I remember there was a clarinet festival, International Clarinet Festival, they had several years ago, and I remember the room was packed with clarinet luminaries like mm-hmm. yourself. I was sitting behind Larry Combs, who was principal clarinet in the Chicago Symphony. I mean, you name it, they were in the room. I'm mm-hmm. sure you were there. They gave Jaime Vaxman an honorary membership to the International Clarinet Association.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And when they did, they said, raise your hand if you've played the Jaime Vaxman clarinet books. And I played them, mm-hmm. but I thought it was because my teacher studied with him. I didn't realize that everybody played
Everybody them. Played them. Absolutely.
Everybody's hand went up. It was crazy. Mm-hmm. I just, I was like, oh.
It was Vaxman and a lot of Vaxman and Gower. Uh-huh. And I'll tell you a little sequel to that. I would, when I took him for dinner, for lunch, mm-hmm. actually took him out in the morning from his assisted living, we went back to his assisted living place, and we were joined by two ladies mm-hmm. for lunch. The four of us had lunch, and one of the ladies was Helen Gower Chatima. Mm-hmm. In other words, the last time I ever saw Jaime was mm-hmm. with Gower.
Oh, wow.
So, and Vaxman and Gower, you look at those books, and it's all Vaxman and Gower.
Yeah, yeah, it's a huge legacy of mm-hmm. of teaching all of us. I mean, mm-hmm. I learned so much from those books, and I still use them with my students.
They're good. They're organizing. And
yeah.
Another thing about the advanced method, he started that when he was in high school.
Really?
Yeah. My book, Woodwind Cookbook. Mm-hmm. The publisher wanted 57 articles. I got to 56 articles. I'm the editor of the book. And I said, because if you need 57 articles, you ask 80 people for articles because you only get 42 or something. Mm-hmm. So then you ask another 15 people and you get 8, kind of thing. And so I got to 56. And so I asked the publisher, why don't you let me do an interview with Jaime Vaxman.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, okay. So, in that interview, I asked him, where did the advanced method come from? He said, well, I started it when I was in high school put together a bunch of exercises. And they originally published it as the Gower and Vaxman clarinet method. It was by, I forget who published it, somebody in Kansas City, I think. Mm-hmm. And then that they sold, they printed 500 copies or something and sold them out, and that was the end of it. So then I went to Rubank.
Wow. That's an incredible life that guy had. I remember at that same festival, the young clarinetist at the time, Julian Bliss, was to play.
Oh, yeah, right.
And he was 10. He came out, and he was barely as tall as the piano.
Yeah.
And I remember the room was, like, sold out. Like, there were people from the town who just came to see this mm-hmm. young clarinetist. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting, again, behind those guys, Mr. Vaxman and Larry Combs and some others. And then I was dubious about Julian Bliss, about how good he was actually going to be. Mm-hmm. And then he came out and played, and it was better than I thought it was going to be in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. He played from memory. It was a beautiful sound, all that stuff. And I remember looking at Jaime Voxman's face, and he looked pleasantly surprised too. Yeah. And now fast forward all these years, Julian Bliss is like a great soloist. And
sure, he's a good guy. I just saw him in Amsterdam about a few months ago. He's a good guy.
Yeah, it was a fascinating moment for me to see the past and the future of clarinet all in front of me at once. Mm-hmm. It was crazy. Let's do a little bit of listening. We're going to listen to a work that I have not played, but I need to. It's performed by you and pianist Susan Grace, and it comes from your CD called Simply Piano and Clarinet. And this piece has a lot of really, really nice standard things on it. And I suppose this would be medium standard, but it's just not something, I don't know, it's on the edges of standard repertoire, perhaps.
You're talking about the Micinski?
Delmas.
Delmas, yeah. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't know the piece.
Yeah.
It's worthy of, it's kind of along the same ilk as the Debussy Rhapsody, but mm-hmm. not, it's not Claude Debussy, and it's still an awfully nice piece.
Yeah. Well, let's give a listen. This is the Fantaisie Italienne for clarinet and piano by Marc Delmas. This is Charles West and Susan Grace. Thank you. That was the Fantasy Italienne by Mark Delma, performed by Charles West clarinet and Susan Grace piano. And I'm here with Charles West today. This guy has an amazing career behind him, and it's still going even though he's in retirement.
I'm not good at retirement. I'm failing at retirement.
It would be hard, especially, I mean, the thing that you do so well, it would be hard to just leave it behind. And, you know, sometimes I think, oh, yeah, I definitely want that. But I don't know, if I did it and then there was like a month went by, would I be like, what now? I don't know.
Yeah, it's a funny feeling.
Yeah.
It's a funny feeling, yeah, when you leave the job.
Mm-hmm.
But I can, you know, things just fall into my, you know, would you like to do this? And
Yeah.
Somebody wants a sectional or, you know, waves some money for some little thing, and it's... You know, I think you would have the same thing happen.
Probably.
Things would fall into your lap because everybody knows you too, and you don't realize how famous you've become in our
little clarinet world.
Yeah, and beyond, I think. But you're respected and well known. We know who you are.
Well, that's good. Yeah. It's a good place to be. Speaking of well known, you know or knew a very famous composer whose music has been played a lot by clarinet players over the years, Robert Micinski, because he was on faculty when you were on faculty at the University of Arizona, right?
That's right. His door was two doors down, his office two doors down from mine.
Now tell me about that, about knowing him, and then we're going to listen to your recording of Timepieces, which was not a lot recorded piece.
No, only Mitchell Lurie had recorded before I did.
Yeah. And even now, there aren't that many recordings of this piece, but it's a great piece. It's one of the pieces. Yeah. Tell me about Robert Micinski.
Well, he was one of these guys that edited, I mean, changed things. I mean, you have to almost hog-tie him to get things out of his hands because he was just meticulous as could be. And he and I were good friends. We actually were in a trio together. He was the pianist, and Teddy McMillan was the violinist, so clarinet, violin, piano. And so we would go places and play. But Bob was a very quiet man. And it's almost like, you remember the little guy in Little Abner that the cloud was over his head?
Mm-hmm.
It's like sort of a cloudy guy. But then... But then he'd get behind the piano, and Dr. Jekyll would become Mr. Hyde.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went down to his office the first time. I mean, I've been working on the piece, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And he plays the opening on piano, and fire comes off the keyboard, you know. And he stops and says, I want more power, you know, kind of thing. And so, I blew my brains out on the thing and played it that way. And he said, I like that. And
that first movement is an explosion, isn't it?
It is. It is. Mitchell Lurie had recorded it with Bob on the piano. But Mitchell, beautiful guy and great, great, great player, far, far greater player than I will ever be. But he had open heart surgery not long before he recorded it, so he was not willing to bust a gut on it. You know, he was his recording is kind of gentle by comparison, and so when I sent Bob the recording, he said, "Ah, that's what I want."
Oh, well, that's good.
So if I could have just had Mitchell Lurie's sound and finesse, then on top of the power of it. Then I wrote an article about it for the Clarinet Magazine, a masterclass article.
Uh-huh.
And this was back before email. So I sent him a draft of the article.
In snail mail.
In snail mail, you're right, yeah. U.S. mail. And typed out stuff. And I'd used the expression violence. He says he wanted violence in his, and the only thing he corrected was he crossed it out and he says, I prefer power.
Power.
Yeah, he didn't like violence.
Okay.
He prefer power. And so
I respect that.
Yeah, and so that edit, of course, it's in the published article. It's 20 years ago, or more, a long time ago.
Yeah, I read that one.
Yeah.
Every time that magazine came out to have another master class from some great person about a piece that they have a lot of connection to.
Mm. Well, I felt an obligation to since I was the last person, and Bob died not long after I left Arizona. Mm-hmm. And I John Denman had played it with him also, but John passed away. Mm-hmm. And so I said, man, I'm the last living person.
Last connection.
To Machinsky, I'd better write something out. Mm-hmm. And do that. And actually, there's a letter from Machinsky to me about that, and I turned it over to the Clarinet magazine. I don't know if they published it yet, but mm-hmm. I think you might want this because it concerns the timepieces. But he had an earlier work which we also recorded, the Fantasy Trio, mm-hmm. and of course
for clarinet, cello, and piano.
Yeah, another really really good piece.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. Well, I've always wondered, like, what he meant by timepieces. And I saw Denise Gainey, the clarinet teacher at UAB, years ago, perform this piece, and she told us what it meant for her. And so she had, like these little personal stories that mm-hmm. were connected with each movement, which I thought was a really cool thing to do, to try to interpret, because we're always kind of looking inward to try to bring something out mm-hmm. of the music. But did he have like a specific, when he called this piece his timepieces, did he have a specific greater notion involved?
You know, I'm looking you in the face thinking, I think I knew that at one time, and I don't know that now. I think he was a little ambiguous yeah. about it. But I'll tell you something else about it. The third movement that was the first one written, and it was written for flute. Mm-hmm. And he wrote, of course, Mitchell Lurie, who was big Los Angeles clarinetist. We all know who Mitchell Lurie was. Mm-hmm. Mitchell had commissioned the piece, and he got three movements written. Bob got three movements written. He thought, I just need a fourth movement in there. So he went to his notebooks and found this flute piece, and he said, I think we'll rewrite that. So he transposed it and, you know, rewrote it for the clarinet, and that became the third movement. But it was the first movement to have been written for that piece.
Wow. Well, when my students ask me what does timepieces mean, I always don't know if this is true, but to me it kind of means like it's connected to the rhythm and the it's a very like mathematical mm-hmm. type piece, mm-hmm. which isn't totally true because there are some really rubato sections in the second, third movement. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of where I try to go with that a little bit. But I need to revisit your article.
I think that's legit, but mm-hmm. but I'm not ready to sit here on public radio and proclaim that this is why it is. Because, you know.
Well, let's give a listen to the great timepieces by Robert Machinsky. This is Charles West clarinet and Susan Gray's piano. Thank you. That was Timepieces by Robert Micinski with Charles West clarinet and Susan Grace piano. I'm here in the studio today with Charles West. And I got to give a shout out to my former student, Tyler Wilson, who enjoyed one of your master classes that you did for us during COVID when we did it on Zoom. He loved it. And he is now a student at the University of South Florida. pursuing a clarinet performance career slash life. Yeah. And I texted him last night. I said, Tyler, what do you think I should ask him? And he's like, oh, I've got this one. So here's his first question. How did you balance your performance career with your teaching career? That's a tough one.
Just did both of them whole hog. And I mean, I'm a morning practicer. Uh-huh. Got up early in the morning, practiced. Yeah, I mean, you know, you go through different phases. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you're playing a lot, and you're always teaching a lot. You just do everything. You put the pedal to the metal and do it. I think other parts of my life suffered recreational.
Yeah, that's the hard thing, isn't it, to balance this? Because, you know, you look at the clarinet, it seems like a simple thing. You know, it comes in a little box, you put it together, you play it. You don't realize how it can take over your life.
But what's in the box, you don't own what's in the box, it owns you.
Yes, oh my gosh, that's a really good way to put it. It's probably true with the other instruments too, the piano. I heard Billy Joel one time say, the piano it's like the keys are teeth, and they're going to bite him if he plays it. I try not to feel that way about my clarinet, but I do. I totally can see how it can just take every part of you.
But I don't think one of those things excludes the other. And I think the more I have played, the better I've taught, I think. Mm-hmm. Even I'm teaching at East Carolina University 2 days a week. Mm-hmm. For the rest of the semester to fill in, but I'm playing a lot right now, mm-hmm. and sit down beside the students, and I think it's important. I mean, they hear me at 7:30 in the morning warming up in my office. Mm-hmm. I never used to warm up in my office. I used to warm up at home, and you know, like 9:30 would come, and I'd throw the clarinet in the box, and I'd get in for the 10 o'clock. I'd get in at like 1.5 minutes before 10, and mm-hmm. pull the thing in. But the kids all knew that reed was wet, mm-hmm. and the horn was warm, and I sat down, and I wasn't just starting cold. But I think it's important for the kids at East Carolina to hear the old man warm up in the morning. And, you know, when I tell them to do something, like do a vade mecum or something like that, he said, well, he's doing it himself. He's practicing what he preaches. You got to practice what you preach.
Absolutely. And it's not always easy to do that, especially if you're tired or busy or whatever. Speaking of tired, here's another question. He said, what do you believe is most important to learn for your non-performance-driven music majors / music ed majors?
You have to be as good a musician as you can possibly be. And the clarinet or the instrument is a vehicle for that. I mean, I don't buy that you don't have to perform. Play well to teach well. I think the better you play, and that's not a one-to-one relationship. But mm-hmm. I think it's important to have your theory, you know, really down tight. Have your mm-hmm. history really down tight. Have your techniques, your woodwind techniques, your brass techniques, down tight kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I use string tech. I mean, I've been 24 years of orchestra conducting now. I don't play the violin.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've had to dig, you know. The other thing is don't quit learning. Mm-hmm. Stay curious.
You know, I was thinking about for us music teachers, especially those of us who are teaching lessons or running a rehearsal, whatever. Some people go, if you're going to teach a class, they have a lecture and they're going to talk about, you know, whatever, some topic. Mm-hmm. But with us, we kind of go and react to what we're given from the student in a lesson. And so it's not like you can ever really plan. You can kind of have like a game plan, like, okay, we're going to work on this today because you know what the student is going to bring in and you kind of have an idea of what they need. Mm-hmm. But I think that speaks to your point of you just have to be as good as you can be, because that's the only way you're going to be able to pull that information to try to give it to the students, or at least tell them how to get it out of their own playing.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you got to have just such a wealth of backlog to draw from. Yeah, I think you've expressed it perfectly well.
Thank you. I want you to tell me about a time that you were traveling that was just incredibly memorable, whether like performing, teaching. I know that you've been around the world. You've done it all. And tell me about a time where you were just like, I wish everybody could see this right now. I wish people could see what's happening.
I've done a bunch of concerts in Taiwan. Uh-huh. And the Taiwanese audiences are different. They're really different. Yeah. And they're wonderful audiences. They're wonderful, genuine, loving audiences, but their traditions are different. Mm-hmm. And my very first time I played in Taipei, I was flying over, and they pulled us down in San Francisco because, I don't know, a toilet was plugged on the airplane. I don't know why they pull airplanes down and mm-hmm. keep them overnight, but they gave us a toothbrush that the bristles ended up in your mouth, you know, because your stuff was already on the airplane.
Yeah.
And a hotel room and a meal voucher. So I got to Taipei, you know, like 18 hours too late, and they whisked me up and took me to the pianist's house to rehearse. And then they had a lesson for me to teach after that. Then they took me out for dinner, and then I slept, and the next day I did this recital, and I went out and I played. I remember I had six pieces on the recital. Mm-hmm. I don't remember what the pieces were, but I went out and I played the first piece, and I thought it went pretty well. And the people applauded, and I walked toward the edge of the stage, and the applause stopped before I hit the edge of the stage.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I said, gee, they must have thought it was awful. Uh-huh. And I went out and played the second piece, and when I left the stage, I walked a little faster.
Yeah.
And then same thing, the applause stopped, and I, at intermission, I'm just grieving. I'm saying, they must have such high stand. They must hear really, really much better people than I'll ever be. You know, and so played the second half, and the same stuff, and it was just, it rattled me, really rattled me. And at the end of the program, walked off the stage, applause stops. And I went, and I sat down, and the applause started again. I said, go out, take another bow. And so I went out, took another bow. I didn't walk all the way to the center of the stage. Mm-hmm. Came back, and the applause stopped. And then the applause started again. I said, you guys are messing with me. Uh-huh. I ended up playing an encore.
Really?
Yeah.
It's just like a more reserved culture where they're not going to give it to you.
It's just a funny little thing. We did several, the same pianist and I, did several recitals, mm-hmm. going from Taipei down on the way to Kaohsiung, Taichung. We played in Taichung, and just those got used to the audiences.
Yeah. I just want to thank you for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me, my friend. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. You've been listening to Clarinet Corner, a production of Troy Public Radio and produced by Joey Hudson. I'm Tim Phillips, and there's a lot more where that came from. This is Troy Public Radio.